David Kenny of Everything Old is New Again every Sunday night at 10. Please join me then, and please support WBAI at our brand new old number, which is 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. Hey, it's our old number, but it's new again, because everything old is new again. I like it.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today I'm honored to welcome my guest, Ms. Beverly Thorpe. She is co-founder of Clean Production Action. She has researched and promoted clean production strategies internationally since 1986, and she co-founded Clean Production Action as a resource to advance a non-toxic economy. Previously, Ms. Thorpe was the first clean production liaison and technical expert for Greenpeace International on chemical and waste issues. Her work on alternatives to PVC plastics and hazardous waste incineration help drive momentum for safer substitution practices in companies. As the NGO representative in the first United Nations Environment Program for Cleaner Production, she promoted the value of public participation in industrial policies. And her work extended to agriculture when she worked with the U.S. farming community to document the increased chemical risks of GMO crops. Her current work focuses on the connection between our climate crisis and the petrochemical industry's expansion for plastics production. She authored the Safer Solutions Policy Paper, which is a roadmap to transform the chemical industry, and I'll provide a link to that report. Ms. Thorpe received her degree in geography from Leicester University in the UK and is an annual lecturer at Lund University in Sweden on chemicals, policy, and corporate practices. She is a previous director of Greenpeace International and the Story of Stuff in the United States. And she comes to us today from Toronto, Canada. Welcome, Bev.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I heard you speak at the Collaborative on Health and the Environment, where you spoke about the triple planetary crises, which we are going to dive into in a moment. But first, I was curious to know what led to your interest in chemicals.
It all began after I finished my degree. Part of my degree in geography was environmental biology, and I ended up becoming a toxics campaigner for Greenpeace in the UK, in London, in England. And at that time, the organization was very focused on protection of the marine environment. And at the time, there was a lot of toxic waste dumping and river discharges from highly polluting industries into the North Sea and into the Mediterranean, into all the world's oceans. So we did what Greenpeace does. We highlighted the problem, and we got a lot of international convention bans on ocean incineration and dumping of toxic waste at sea. But I kept asking myself as we toured around to some of these very polluted areas, why are facilities using such hazardous chemicals? And there must be a better way. How can we stop the discharge of such toxic pollution into the world's oceans? So as you start going upstream, you find that there are ways that companies can substitute to safer chemicals. And that's what drove me to work with the whole new field of cleaner production, as it was called at the time in the 1990s. And one of the reasons why I co-founded Clean Production Action, which is a way to establish tools and strategies to help businesses identify chemicals of high concern and find safer alternatives. So it was very much a solutions mission. I realized you can always point out the big problems that are happening around the world, but how do we set these roadmaps to a safer, non-toxic economy?
Right. And, you know, you bring up a good point about safer alternatives. I think there's a lot of greenwashing there. So I'm thinking about food materials specifically, such as BPA. We learned that this was a dangerous chemical that was being released from plastic coatings in cans, for example, or leaching or migrating out of plastic cups. And so there were substitution chemicals like BPS. And then we find out that that is really not any safer. But still, we see those BPA-free labels on plastics, and the consumer automatically thinks, oh, well, then this is safe then.
I know. I think the thing, when you start working with chemicals, it becomes tricky because the consumer just sees a bunch of these BPA-free or paraben-free, and so you just assume that the company has taken measures to actually find safer substitutes. But the reality is that many of the people working in companies simply ask their suppliers to give them BPA-free alternatives. And because they're not actually screening what these alternatives are or asking their suppliers to show that they're safe and don't have the same hormone disrupting properties as the chemical they want to get rid of, we're losing that focus on truly understanding what is safer. The good news is that here we are in 2024. We have so many great certifications. We have so many good chemical hazard assessment screening tools like the green screen for safer chemicals. If a company had run their alternative through the green screen, they would have seen it had similar hazard profile. So companies now and employees in companies have to be a lot more careful and really understand and ask the right questions of their suppliers.
Well, I will provide a link to green screen. And the term that we're talking about here when we talk about substitutes that are no safer, I love it. It's regrettable substitutes.
I know. Isn't that a great term?
Yes, it is.
But it's a term that came out of the EPA and it's now been adopted internationally. So we stick with the term a regrettable substitute. We sometimes say it's like jumping out of the frying pan into the fire. You really don't want to do that. You want to make sure that you have full material data. You have full ingredient disclosure. You have assessed the alternatives and you've put them into your new product design. The good news is that this is happening more than I think people understand, but quite often people who are doing this type of great, what's called informed substitution, they're not as big marketing the fact that they phased out one thing and moved into something safer. And there's various reasons why they do that, because in some ways it sort of admits that they were using something toxic in the first place. But believe me, I do have hope that there is this trend towards safer chemical adoption amongst what we would call front runners in the company world.
Right. When do you think you first became aware of the threats from single-use food and beverage packaging?
The whole issue of plastics is highly tied to the whole petrochemical system, because the chemical industry is set to double globally within the next 6 years by 2030, which is a huge problem globally. I worked internationally and we could see the problems of toxic chemical production and exposure around the world. The problem is that much of this new chemical production increase is going into plastics. And the last thing we need on this world is more plastic waste, more plastic exposure, and certainly for fence line communities who are living in areas where all these petrochemical plants are based, more hazardous and more toxic exposure from the production of plastics, which is highly hazardous. So the issue of plastics has always been in that whole field that all of us worked on. And how do you move towards a non-toxic economy? How do you reduce the use of toxic chemicals in products and packaging? But the reality is that plastics themselves now, in some ways, epitomize the problem with the petrochemical production of hazardous chemicals. It's all baked into plastics now.
Yeah, I think our awareness of the risks of plastic has certainly increased, but at the same time, our choices in the marketplace seem to be decreasing. And I'll give you a personal example. I was on the road and I went into a supermarket to look for organic mayonnaise. It had to be organic and it also had to be in glass. And I had to stop in three stores before I found a product that passed my criteria. But what that taught me was that even if people want to avoid single-use plastics or the migration of toxic chemicals from plastic food packaging, it is extremely difficult to do so.
It is. Part of the problem is that plastic is cheap. And this is a problem we face all the time when you can look at some of the most highly hazardous materials on the market today, such as vinyl flooring. If you are trying to cut costs it's just cheaper to put in vinyl flooring. And even though vinyl flooring off gases a lot of very hazardous chemicals into the air, it's cheap. And so you have to keep saying, why are toxic materials cheap? And again, this comes back down to the fossil fuel sector. It's cheap because the fossil fuel sector is highly subsidized. If we actually put the full cost accounting on the fracking, on the oil and gas extraction, on the types of hazardous chemicals that are creating massive human health and environmental waste problems around the world, you would not see such cheap plastics on the market today.
Yeah. You know, I'm an upstream thinker, and I think you are too. Certainly in public health, we like to do that. Rather than treating the symptoms downstream, we like to look upstream to stop the problem at the get-go. And so I try to think, okay, what policies really need to change here in order for us to see reduced plastic in our environment? And I too got to this subsidy issue. How much hope do you have in seeing an end to the subsidizing of the fossil fuel industry so that plastics are not so cheap?
I would say that because there are so many diverse voices calling for this, we have to build up the community of scientists, international organizations, respected authorities, economists. We have to build up this voice to call for an end to subsidies on fossil fuel. And I know that this is really being pushed by the renewable energy sector because they're facing unfair competition. But from the petrochemical and the plastics and the toxic chemical community that are trying to see green chemistry and safer materials, we're now seeing this coalition of common voice saying that we have to cut the subsidies on fossil fuels. And I'm talking about organizations even like the International Energy Agency is calling for an end to fossil fuel subsidies on the petrochemical sector. You're seeing the United Nations calling for this as regards the Global Plastics Treaty that's currently being written and set to be finalized in 2025. So people are now just talking in one voice that we have to change the roadmap, not just from a climate crisis point of view, but also from a toxic and plastics point of view.
That is very hopeful. Tell me a little bit more about the Global Plastics Treaty. What are the key points that you'd like us to know about that?
The Global Plastics Treaty is showing that there's two sides to how people are trying to say, yes, we have to cut plastic pollution. The whole point of the Global Plastics Treaty is how do we end plastic pollution? You have two camps coming up right now. You have the camp where they, mostly from the petrochemical sector and plastics producers themselves, saying we simply have to have better waste management. The second camp, which is growing in popularity and growing in strength, is we have to absolutely cut the production of new plastic. The world cannot take any more chemical pollution and plastic assault from a big planetary point of view. In fact, a paper that came out 2 years ago talks that we have reached the planetary boundaries for chemical pollution. It is now similar as we are at code red for the climate crisis. We're at code red for chemical pollution, which has been confirmed by the latest global chemical outlook, which says that this massive expansion or doubling of chemical production by 2030 is happening with no controls, with lack of regulations, lack of even categorization of why more chemicals are needed. And then when you realize most of this is going into plastics, you can understand why people are saying we have to cap production of plastics. So I think the truth will be in the final draft that comes out of this Global Plastics Treaty, if we can see an actual cap, an end to the production of new petrochemicals and plastics. We have enough chemicals on the market today. We have to be generating new forms of chemicals which are bio-based and benign and following green chemistry principles. We have to completely transform the petrochemical sector. And to do that, we have to really focus on capping the increased production of plastics.
Mm. Let me take one break and remind our listeners that if you're just joining us, you're tuned into Food Sleuth Radio, and today we are joined by Ms. Beverly Thorpe. She is co-founder of Clean Production Action, which is a resource to advance a non-toxic economy. Okay, Bev, I'm sure that there will be great opposition to the Global Plastics Treaty by those who profit from plastic production and plastic use. What are some strategies for us to help get through the opposition and the messaging, the greenwashed messaging that will no doubt come as a part of that?
Well, there's many levels that people can get involved, certainly from our personal level of involvement. I agree with you. It's often hard to find non-plastic packaging. And I've studied the amount of migration that comes from the chemicals in plastics, from packaging into our food. And it's sometimes hard. I also go looking for natural mayonnaise in glass bottles, and I can usually find it somewhere. But we have to really start talking to the supermarket chains and the retailers that we frequent, saying, what is your policy on plastic? How are you going to get rid of single-use plastics? It's just a necessity right now. It's not a consumer choice. It really is an environmental necessity right now and a human health necessity. Maybe we also have to have more understanding of the types of health impacts that using plastic packaging actually is having on our kids' health. Certainly baby food should be in glass. It should not be in plastics. And yet you see that everywhere. Part of the problem is that the regulations are not keeping up with the science on what is actually migrating from plastics into food. A case in point is PFAS. Some people have heard of these forever chemicals. It's a big class of chemicals, about the 9,000 to 12,000 in existence. And they're used widely to coat the insides of packaging to give oil resistance, grease resistance, water resistance. The lining in your pizza box can be coated with PFAS, but food contact materials are actually one of the main sources for us to be exposed to these forever chemicals. And with the result that all of us now have these chemicals in our bodies, we're all contaminated with PFAS chemicals, which is really disturbing when you connect the dots, because this class of chemicals is really well connected to different types of cancer, disruptions to the thyroid, they're hormone disruptors, they're really hitting our immune system. So I think the more that we become aware of what's happening to us, the more we need to be pushing our regulators to ban PFAS in all food packaging, as one example. And a lot of groups are having success in the U.S. right now. There's 11 states that have banned PFAS in food packaging. And two major chains, both McDonald's and Starbucks, have now committed to eliminating PFAS by 2025. But again, the average consumer doesn't understand this or know this. And so this again comes down to regulations. Industry prefers regulations. They know where they stand. If they know that a PFAS ban is going to come up in the next 2 to 3 years, they work with their supply chain to get these kind of chemicals out. The same with plastics in general. If the reuse and the durable packaging economy can flourish, then through consumer demand, we're going to see more production of reuse, returnable, reusables that are not based on plastics. This is a big issue because the industry will say, well, plastics are light. You're creating more carbon dioxide if you use heavier materials, right? You hear this all the time, but you have to look at the benefits of moving to materials that are not going to poison us. We can't afford the leaching of these hazardous chemicals into our food supply, particularly for kids. We're just talking about food. You know, this extends to the PFAS use in carpets in our homes and the widespread use of it in all sorts of other materials. But I know from a food perspective, why can't we have our milk or whatever vegan alternative you have in glass bottles that you bring back and you buy refilled again? I grew up in that economy and it was normal. All our drinks came in bio-based materials or they came in glass. I think some plastics can be designed with low hazard materials that are bio-based, that are fossil free, and that can be reused and composted safely at their end of life. But we can't just jump from massive use of single use fossil fuel based plastics to massive use of bio-based plastics. We have to really look at the consumption of all our materials and figure out a way to have the same benefits of good, healthy food, but with less waste and less toxics.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned regulation. And here in the United States, we hear a lot of anti-regulation rhetoric. But you bring up a really good point, and that is it enables everyone to be on a level playing field. So one manufacturer might volunteer to be a good guy and say, I'm not going to include plastics. They may be cheaper, but they're harmful. Whereas if you have a regulation that denies everyone the ability to use a toxic compound, then one person isn't going to be at a financial advantage over another. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. In fact, every company that we've worked with who have tried to get rid of hazardous chemicals in their supply chain and reuse materials, and they've done extensive testing, they all say, we need regulations to come in to level this playing field. We're doing the right thing, but if we're going to be outcompeted by people who don't care and can just produce hazardous materials on the market, why would we continue to do that? Now, some companies will stake their branding on that and say, we cost more, but this is the ethics that we work by. Here's our chemical policy. It's on our web. It's in our yearly corporate responsibility report. And that does attract a lot of buyers. And in some cases, the big procurement groups will particularly look out for providers of materials and products that have done this great chemical policy review. But for you and me facing a cost of living crisis, we often have to choose the cheapest, which is often the most hazardous. So we do need regulations to set that level playing field. And I'm happy to say that in the States, certainly on the PFAS contamination issue, you're seeing a lot of great regulations coming through.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I do want to make sure we touch on that triple planetary crises point that you made during the Collaborative for Health and the Environment webinar. It was excellent, and I'll provide a link for our listeners. But you raised three issues: biodiversity loss, chemical assault, and climate change. What would you like our listeners to know about this concept of triple planetary crises?
The triple planetary crisis is a term that even the UN uses now: biodiversity loss, chemical pollution, and climate crisis. And I think it encapsulates those three big pockets of our poor little planet that is being, from my perspective, the work I do on chemicals. The chemical crisis and the climate crisis are so tied at the hip right now that I think we can work collectively to address both at the same time. The biodiversity crisis is also happening because of the use of pesticides and herbicides in agriculture, and the fact that we've now effectively coated the planet with microplastics. It's in our food, it's in our water, the same with many hazardous chemicals. PFAS is called the forever chemical class because it will persist for 1,000 years. We have to cap the production of these types of well-known, persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic chemicals. But by addressing the fossil fuel sector itself, you're addressing the plastic chemical crisis and the climate crisis together. All roads lead back to the petrochemical and fossil fuel industry. And so it does offer us a real focal point to talk about cutting subsidies, moving financial incentives to green chemistry, to a renewable energy future, to cutting consumption through public transport. I mean, there's all these wonderful, healthy-based solutions there waiting. We have to just focus on this nexus between the fossil fuel and the petrochemical sector. And the good news is that people are now waking up to this coalition, and the plastics issue is right between the two. Because if we allow the petrochemical sector to expand for more plastic production, we're going to be missing the climate change, greenhouse gas emission reductions that we so desperately need over the next decade.
I think about food and agriculture as touching on each of those three items, the biodiversity loss, the chemical assault, and climate change. So I was really interested in the connection between fossil fuels and pesticides and fertilizers. It doesn't seem like there's a connection between those, but there is. And we just have a couple of minutes remaining. Can you send us off with some education on that point?
Yeah, most of the fertilizers and pesticides that are carbon-based are petroleum carbon-based. So the petrochemical sector is a massive producer of pesticides, herbicides, and fertilizers. And if you move to an organic form of agriculture, you are not reliant on fossil fuel-based petrochemicals, and you are going to enhance the stability of the soil. You're going to sequester more carbon. You're going to have safer food. You're not going to have pesticide residues, herbicide residues. One of the things I learned when I was talking to farmers back in 2000 was since the generation of glyphosate and Roundup Ready or glyphosate resistant crops that were put on the market in 1996, I remember talking to farmers and they were saying that we're now seeing weed resistance from the increasing use of herbicides, from glyphosate, particularly from Roundup. We're seeing weed resistance, and now some of the farmers are back to using 2,4-D, which is known to be a really hazardous chemical. But this rise in weed resistance is now to the point that glyphosate is now the biggest use of herbicide in all U.S. agriculture. But look at the weed resistance. Look at the more intense toxic herbicides and pesticides that farmers now have to spray. So it all comes back down to trying to understand that the petrochemical sector does produce so many hazardous chemicals that are used widespread, not just in the agricultural community and in our industrial food systems, not just in the increased plastic production. More than 50% of plastics on the market are for food packaging and single-use plastics, which we do not need. We have to come to a better way of delivering fresh food without these hazardous materials. But also the fossil fuel sector and the petrochemical sector are the big corporate problem behind why we're not seeing a renewable future. Certainly the money that's going into the type of renewable energies we need are not coming out of those corporations whose trillion-dollar profits are based on the continuous pumping of fossil fuels. So the whole thing comes back down to we have to go to a fossil fuel-free future. I totally believe it's possible, but we have to keep our focus on where is the money going? Why is single-use plastic so cheap? Why can't I go and find reusable glass bottles for my food in my supermarket? And they'll tell you it's an economic issue. So I'm sorry to keep coming back down to the subsidies that are going into the fossil fuel sector, but it's so connected. To get to real solutions, we have to look at where the money's going.
Thank you. We've got to close. We're out of time, but I want to thank our listeners for joining us. Remind everyone that Food Sleuth Radio is produced by Dan Hemmelgarn for KOPN in Columbia, Missouri. But most of all, I want to thank my guest, Ms. Beverly Thorpe, co-founder of Clean Production Action, a resource to advance a non-toxic economy. Bev, thank you so much for sharing your time with me today.
Thank you.
Accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
This is Charles Barron, the co-host of Speaking Truth to Power with my beautiful African queen, Inez Barron. We are going to be kicking it off April 12th from 5 to 6 p.m. every Friday on WBAI. You want to listen to this program because we're going to bring the fire. We're going to bring the truth. All of the traitors, the sellouts, you better be trembling in your boots because we are going to expose the truth. We're going to bring a black radical revolutionary perspective to politics and economics and the social issues of our time. Speaking Truth to Power will be an unbossed, uncompromised, unchained voice.